Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we're going to continue our ongoing exploration of the cultures of consciousness. Lately, I have been thinking a lot about the sense of wonder. It's a powerful part of our lives, and yet as adults, we often pay very little attention to it and let it grow fallow. And we think of it as something kind of associated with children. And in fact, it's something that we enjoy about being around children, is we can tell that they are experiencing this kind of heightened, imaginatively stimulated sense, but it's often triggered by things in the world. It's not just their own imaginations or their own dreams. It's just the world itself, a butterfly, a caterpillar, a weird mark on the side of a building can be the occasion for wonder. And as we get older, that sense tends to atrophy. And I think a lot of the appeal of things like video games and Hollywood blockbusters is because it allows us in a very easy way to re-stimulate some of these older senses within us. Because I think there's something very profound, very essentially human about the state of wonder, and that it has value unto itself. But one of the reasons it's hard for us to tune into it as adults is because it's so directly, and yet in such a playful, ambiguous way, challenges the rationality that we largely turn ourselves over to, at least as far as getting through the day, of being an ego who has plans and problems to solve and desires to satisfy, and the whole machinery of rationality that we invoke in order to deal with our contemporary society, and indeed just to be a functioning egos, is sort of deeply puzzled, if not upset and even offended by the category of wonder, because at the heart of wonder is the pleasure of not knowing, the pleasure of being in ambiguity, in what Keats called negative capability. And from that place, you can't reason very hard, at least for the time being of that experience. And so I really think that considering the places in our lives where we allow a sense of wonder to exist without it meaning anything, without it being tied to any belief system, without it being linked to some cosmic concept or metaphysics, but simply the experience itself is a door opener to deeper states of consciousness and I think just a richer experience of life. And these thoughts have been stimulated by reading and encountering the work of our guest today, whose name is Eugene Berger, and he is one of the preeminent philosophers of magic, of conjuring performance, as well as a great conjurer himself. And I'm delighted that he has deigned to join us here on Expanding Mind. But before I bring Eugene on, I just wanted to say hi to our co-host, the esoteric librarian from L.A., Maja. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, Eric. How are you?
Very good. Is there anything that you do consciously in the midst of your very busy days of that encourages or inculcates the sense of wonder?
Well, it's funny because actually all the wonder enters me unconsciously, which is what the word means. In fact, the word wonder actually comes from and is related to the word astonish, which means literally like to stun or daze or render unconscious. So actually when we go into a state of wonder, it's literally like we are rendered unconscious. And to me, that's like when you get to be dreaming when you're awake. Because when you go into wonder, you get to just open the unconscious state while you're awake. And for me, that happens, like, I consciously always kind of have my mind open to it, so I guess I do kind of consciously invite it, but then when it strikes, it's always an unconscious thing, literally, that happens, because I, like, go into dreamland, you know?
That's a wonderful way to put it. It's like a little mini trance that descends upon us. But I think you're right. There is something fundamentally passive about it, at least initially, when it strikes us, and that too is part of what makes it difficult, because we so much like to be in control, and reason likes to be in control. We're doing this for this reason, for that reason, and in a way, all you can do is be open to the possibility of wonder, or you can also go see a magic show done by a very, very good conjurer. I can think of no better conjurer to bring on with those words than Eugene Berger. Eugene, thanks so much for joining us here on Expanding Mind.
Well, it's great to be here, and you're very kind.
Well, I always like to start off with a little bit of a personal history, and I know that especially with magicians, they often find their calling at a rather young age, and usually, oftentimes, there's sort of an interesting story attached to that. Can you tell me where and when you were, when you were like, uh-oh, I think I'm going to be a magician?
Well, it wasn't quite like that. I was 8 years old. I was in the balcony of the Oriental Theater in Chicago, second row, and that was the days when they had movies and stage shows, and there was this wonderful magic act, and then and there, 8 years old, I really felt like I was called to be a magician. Now, when I went to college and all, they tried to convince me to do something more worthwhile with my life. But when I was about 39, I finally answered the original call and did what I wanted to do.
So had you been practicing in the interim?
I was really involved in magic until I got to college, and then I slowly got out of it, and then I went to graduate school, and I went into a different world. I kind of kept up a little bit, but I really was more out of it than into it at that point.
And
this is a very interesting pattern that we find a lot with magicians, that they started as kids, and then they went away from it for a while, and then in their 30s or 40s, they returned to it.
Can you say a little bit about what was it that drew you back into it? I mean, it must have been, in some ways, a little risky. Like, you know, you're in your late 30s, and you're like, well, maybe I'll do this magic thing. There must have been a powerful call.
Yes, exactly. Well, at that time, I was director of welfare in Evanston, the suburb north of Chicago. And once I suddenly didn't have a job anymore, I was like, you know, there are two ways of becoming a magician. One is you have so much work that you have to quit your day job. And the other is where you have no work, but you just jump off the cliff and see what happens. So that's what I did. I became very frightened for a while. You know, I mean, I could imagine the headlines, welfare director on welfare. But then I realized that I had an edge because I knew how to fill out the forms. So that made me a little more comforted. So I just jumped into it, and I was very fortunate that it worked. And 30-some years later, I'm still doing it full-time.
Well, I really want to, encourage you to clarify your take on magic, because, again, as you well know, most people have a, you know, fairly light impression of what conjuring performance is these days. Even people who are actually, you know, fans of the art or even practitioners of it often have a, you know, a certain spin on it that's quite different than a lot of the ideas that I, you know, found out about through your work. So could you talk a little bit about, like, what you would say to somebody who just has a sort of, you know, general impression of conjuring performance at this point in history? What are they missing? What's the potential there that is too infrequently realized?
Well, let me just say, first of all, that I think there are a lot of ways of skinning the cat, as it were, and I'm not going to presume that my way is the best way. It's just the way I happen to be in at the moment.
Right.
I'm not going to say that this is the only way to approach magic, because I think if you just approach magic as entertainment, fun, isn't this silly and goofy, that's a valid response. And for some people, that's all that they get out of it, or that's all that they're able to bring to it. Part of it is what we're able to bring to things sometimes. For myself, I think all human behavior is representational, and so magic is representational, too. It points beyond itself to meanings. And we can look at some of the meanings are really kind of amazingly wonderful. You know, there's the trick where the magician cuts a rope and puts it back together again. Well, what's that about? On one level, of course, it's about a rope being cut and put back together again. But on another level, it's about the broken being healed. I mean, that's the metaphor, I think. That's what it's about psychologically, at least to me. And what's broken? Me, you. We're all broken as long as we live ego-driven lives. And the message of this little magic trick, if you want to see it, is the broken can be healed. I'll just give you one more example, and then you can jump in. The trick where the rings get linked and unlinked. What's that about? Well, metaphorically, I think it's about the separate being joined. And who's separate? Well, I'm separate and you're separate. We're all separate. And we all seek community. We seek friendship. We seek love. And the message of this ring trick to me is that the separate can be joined. These are happy messages, I think, that magic gives us, hopeful messages, inspirational messages.
Well, they're totally alchemical, too, and that's one
Absolutely.
Of the things that I love about what you know, just put into your magic is that old hermetic nature of the magician, because it's literally when you're healing and joining those things, it is the, you know, the conjunctio, the unification of the opposites, like taking broken things and making them healed. Like, literally, those tricks are symbolic of that shamanic ability to
Absolutely.
Unify and
Absolutely.
Join. And I was reading some of your articles and interviews, and to me, like, one of the best things, well, you say so many great things, but one of my favorite things is how you compare that deception in magic of the trick to the fool and to that, like, that kind of state of the tarot shamanistic fool state, where that's where, like, the magic and healing can happen.
Yes. Yes, exactly. See, there's, you know, one of the things I ask myself sometimes is, why has magic lasted, theatrical magic lasted? Why didn't people like Steven Spielberg blast theatrical magicians off the face of the planet? Because, Lord, what he can do is far more fabulous than what I can do. But it didn't happen. Magic is still strong. It goes in and out, but I mean, it's been very strong. See, I think magic was transformed, first of all, in the 20th century. Up until that time, magic had a plus and a minus going for it. Magicians were interesting, but they weren't quite fully trusted.
Mm.
And then, in the 20th century, basically, I think, through marketing, the concept of magic became wholly positive. The magic of Macy's. They've been doing that for 2 years now, that campaign. And we have, and we can just go down the list of products that have been sold. I think the people that really helped pull it off, of course, was Disney, in transforming the word magic to something that had a suspect element to it into something that was wholly positive. In fact, if you didn't take your children to the Magic Kingdom, and you could, there was something wrong with you.
Mm. Yeah, that's a really interesting point, because it, I think it ties in with your larger historical picture of magic, and you, I think, with quite a lot of reason, you trace it back to shamanism and presumably to a sort of Paleolithic ritual and ceremony and altered states and this whole long tradition. And if you look at shamans, and if you look at medieval wonder workers, if you look at alchemists, etc., there's always this sense of a little bit of threat in terms of the way the rest of the society sees them. They might have power, but the power is a double-edged sword. Maybe they're a good shaman, maybe they're a bad
right.
shaman. There's always this edge, and yet when you come to the 20th century, I think you're very much correct that not only is the term magic sort of brought into commodity culture, which is itself a very interesting thing to talk about, but the routines that stage magicians deploy
which you also talk about, largely enter the realm of sort of friendly entertainment, you know, a kind of wow, a kind of nifty, and even if there's some extraordinary performers, nonetheless, there's sort of a conscious move away from that darker ambiguity. And I wonder whether it's partly because in the 20th century, on some level, rationality has taken over so thoroughly as our, like, de facto way of viewing the world, that suddenly even the threats that were associated with these other ways of being no longer really register to the average person. It's like they can't even really necessarily perceive that threat, or they need more work to be reminded of what that darker, more intense ambiguity is.
Yes. You know, as Max Maven, who's been on your show, said, you know, magicians in the 20th century accomplished something quite amazing. They took a deep and profound art and completely trivialized it. And that's pretty astonishing when you think about it. Yes, I think, you know, I think there's, to use the word you just used, symbolism. You know, yeah, there's a lot of symbolism going on here, and either you're open to it or you're not, and that's, what, a matter of temperament? Who knows what it's a matter of?
Well, it's interesting to me because, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but part of your, like, one of your missions is to kind of educate magicians on the symbolism behind the things they do. And I know, like, a lot of your writings on magic is to give a kind of introduction to some of the magicians who may not be aware of some of this history and symbolism. And you do try to, you know, I mean, you're kind of leading this movement to reinvigorate that kind of symbolic consciousness into
magician.
Well,
I'm trying to open a door. You're absolutely right, but I'm not trying to push people through it.
Right, right.
That's, I think, the difference. That would be like, you know, having a religion.
Yes.
Something I never really.
But that also has an effect on your performance practice too. It's not just the intellectual history and the philosophy and bringing these ideas into the magic community. I would love to hear you talk a little bit more about bizarre magic, for instance, and the willing invocation of some of these deeper, darker, more occult performance styles and symbols inside of a contemporary magic act. So I'd love to hear how that grew for you and how you discovered those ideas and some of those magicians and took it your own way.
Well, bizarre magic started in the 50s, late 40s and 50s in Scotland and Ireland with Tony Shields in Cornwall, who then moved to Cornwall, England, and Charles Cameron in Edinburgh. And these guys felt that magic needed a Gothic revival, that it had become something so polite and just for the children, you know, and not to be taken seriously by anyone beyond the age of 12. And it was just a reaction to this trivialization of magic. And they started this with jumping on H.P. Lovecraft as the primary metaphorical base. So it was pretty dark stuff. It was about conjuring up monsters and ghosts and whatnot. But you have to just see it as a reaction to magic only for little children's parties. As one of these guys said, magic needs a Gothic revival. And that's what they gave it. And then in America, there were two guys, Tony Raven and my friend Tony Andruzzi, and these guys were the kind of centerpieces of bizarre magic in America. Andruzzi organized 7 conventions that brought people together from all over the world who were interested in this stuff. And the result is that there still is bizarre magic groups. In fact, I'm going to be at a convention in November in Connecticut, Bizarre Magic Convention. But what it did also was open the door to storytelling magic, which was a very old thing that had been almost lost in a way. And so magicians began telling better stories, I think. So in that sense, my view is that bizarre magic was a pretty good healthy movement, not one to get stuck in. I mean, Jeff McBride, I think, was the person who really did the most to dump the H.P. Lovecraft mythos and say, wait a minute, there are sunnier themes that we can go to that is still bizarre, but not necessarily so dark.
Would some of the people who are attracted to that have a more, let's say, ambiguous or even enthusiastic relationship with the occult in general? Because most, maybe not most, but it seems to me that most magicians, professional and even amateur, are invested in a certain kind of debunking at it, or at least a lot of it, you know, with the Penn and Teller being an obvious example.
Yeah, yeah.
That, so obviously these guys have no interest in fomenting or even suggesting any kind that there might be anything interesting or useful about an occult or alchemical symbol.
Right.
But did bizarre magic start to draw people who maybe had a more rich and poetic and maybe even experiential sense of the power of these
absolutely it attracted people that were into magic in a much more formal way and not simply theatrical magic, but it also attracted people who wanted to play act in that arena.
Mm.
You know, dress up and play ritual, and again, I think that there's a value in that for people too, if that's as far as you want to step into the water. I don't think my job, you know, is not to teach manners when I go to a magic show, even though I sometimes run into people that are incredibly rude. But that's not my job, you know, and the same thing here, you know, you can invite people to get into the water, but I don't think you should push them too hard.
What do you kind of see your job as? Is it just to kind of open people's minds like that? Or?
Yes, and to let people see that there are lots of opportunities and there are lots of interpretations beyond the ones that I'm taking to be rock-bottom fact.
Mm.
You know, I mean, one of the things that we do know, well, there was this great statement by Shapiro, you know, the history of medicine has been until recently, the history of medicine has been the history of the placebo effect.
Hmm.
And you want to say to yourself, why until recently? How egotistical of us to think that future generations aren't going to look back at us and say, oh, they were so quaint. And I think that's part of the problem with the debunker attitude, that they're like fundamentalists turned inside out sometimes.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's
you know, it's not like I feel I'm the skeptic because I really don't know. I think that's the heart of what skepticism is, living with courage in spite of the fact that you don't know.
Well, and also the example of the placebo points to the healing effect of these intangible experiences,
right,
of wonder or of
right,
transcendence or transformation. And you've talked a fair amount, and maybe it would be good to go into a little bit about how you see the connection between the kind of conjuring you do and the shamanic tradition and what shamans were actually doing and the role of deception and trickery in shamanism. That's a real fascinating set of arguments you put forward, especially today when there's so many people who are interested in the shamanic legacy.
Yes, and I think that so many forms of popular entertainment arose from shamanism. Ventriloquism, probably certain acrobatics, magic, juggling, you name it, you know, lots of what we would call entertainment arts generated in this way. One of my students, Dr. Ricardo Rosenkrantz, who teaches at Northwestern Medical School here in Chicago, has been doing a class for the last couple of semesters, Magic and Medicine, where he brings in magicians and doctors to talk to these budding doctors. And I've been heavily involved in it since, you know, he's one of my students and kind of he comes to me for advice on different ideas. But this has really gotten a big response. I mean, it just closes out instantly when he offers it. And at the end, you have a choice. You can either write a 10-page paper or you can do a performance.
Well, let me ask you something. I asked Max Maven this question also. Have you ever experienced personally while you were doing, I know it's that like fine line, but you really are kind of a shaman in a way, I think, and since you're so conscious of it, did you ever experience like something where in one of your performances you felt like you kind of healed someone or had a healing effect on it in the stage magic show?
Well, I was doing a lecture for the magicians a couple years ago up in Santa Rosa, California. And the guy who was hosting the lecture was head of an animal clinic, a 24-hour animal clinic. And during the lecture, I noticed a woman come into the room in the back and leave and come in and leave. And I had a sense that maybe she belonged to one of the magicians, either a friend or wife or something. Anyway, when the lecture was over, she came up to me and she said, "Could I talk to you for a minute?" And I said, "Sure." And she said, "You know, you look like the most religious person in the room here. My dog is in the back and she's dying. Would you come and put your hands on her?" Mm. And I said, "Sure." So I went back and there was this old Jack Russell Terrier with lots of tubes in it and a cage, you know. Put my hand on her. And then she said, "And my children haven't even said goodbye." And I said, "You know, if it were my dog, I would take it home right now, because I think the dog would rather die in your lap than in this cage with lots of tubes in it. And then your children could actually be with it and learn a little bit about death and have a family experience together." And she kind of brightened up, you know, and said, "I'm going to do that." And I said, "Good for you." And I presume she did. So, yeah, you get to, you know, you never know when you get to do something in a healing way for others. Now, was there any magic power in my hand touching the dog? Maybe. I'm not going to say there wasn't.
That's interesting. You must have quite a rich experience of how people project power onto you or people who do things
yeah.
like you do. And because a lot of magicians clearly derive a certain kind of not very interesting egoic rush out of a certain
right.
kind of power that's projected onto them. But when that power becomes, when you start to open it up and be more playful with it, and I've seen that also with Max's performances and Jeff's and other people,
mm-hmm.
magicians who seem to be aware of it, then you get to really learn a lot about how people give over power and how they take it back.
Right. And the whole thing is, to say that in a different way is to use the word authority.
Mm. Mm.
You know, that if I want to make the Bible my authority, as Ellen Watts said years ago, okay, but it's you doing it, because you're the ultimate authority. And you can give it away, but you're giving it away. And that's you're still the authority. And you can't get out of being that. But you can give it away. And, of course, what we see over and over in our world politically is people giving away their personal power to hideous theologies of political action.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Well, we're going to take a break now. You're listening to Expanding Mind. I'm Eric Davis with Maja Daou. We're talking with Eugene Berger, and we'll be right back after a couple of messages.
To PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, I'm Carol Brier, host of Community Currency on Progressive Radio Network every Thursday, 5 to 6 p.m. Please join us as we connect people, ideas, important information, and discover solutions to some of the most urgent problems facing us every Thursday, 5 to 6 p.m. Community Currency on Progressive Radio Network.
The shaky economy, peak oil, and now an unstable climate. Get the inside story with Alex Smith on Radio EcoShock. Top scientists find a looming catastrophe while activists try for change. Experts, authors, and alternative media from around the world and around the corner. Hear it all. Radio EcoShock every Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Listen free and live free right here on PRN, ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Don't miss out on Dr. Michio Kaku's weekly show, Explorations. Dr. Kaku is the only scientist with his own nationally syndicated radio show. Explorations is the program that explains complex physics with an accessible approach. So take an exploration with Dr. Michio Kaku, Tuesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, to discuss topics ranging from space exploration to stem cell research.
Do you have a medical question or concern and would like to get a second opinion? If so, make sure you tune in to Second Opinion with Dr. Ronald Klatz. Dr. Klatz is president and founder of the AFREM, American Academy of Anti-Aging Medicine, the largest physician-based anti-aging organization in the world. Each week, Dr. Klatz will talk with expert guests from the field of anti-aging, functional, and regenerative medicine. So if you want to live a longer, healthier life, tune in to Second Opinion with Dr. Klatz Sunday nights at 10 p.m. Eastern here on PRN.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back to Expanding Minds. Eric Davis and I are here talking to Eugene Berger about magic, one of our favorite topics of all time. And Eugene, you were talking about something that I think is really important before the break about giving up power and authority, and that's such a key theme in magic and shamanism, and kind of that difference between good or evil, if you want to make a difference between the two, and that fine line between empowerment and taking people's power away. And there's this thing that has been associated with, like, you know, mentalism and hypnosis and healing and, you know, medicine in general. I think of that difference between, you know, empowering someone to heal themselves and then that doctor telling a person they have cancer and they're going to die. And I was just curious, because you had said that you like to open the door for people but not to push people through the door. And as someone who can navigate mentalism and influence people's consciousness, there is always that kind of lure of power that, you know, maybe you could influence someone. And I was just wondering if you had an experience that kind of inspired you to make sure that you were conscious not to kind of, you know, push people through doors, but just to open their minds, which is more empowering than taking the power away.
I can't think of any specific experience. I think it's a realization that just grew on me. You know, one of the reasons why magic works, but one of the reasons is that people believe what they're told. they don't think, they just believe it. And that's part of the magician's power. You know, years ago I used to do a lot of bar mitzvahs, and that's the worst job in the world, because a 13-year-old boy is possibly the worst audience for a magician on the planet. Because these kids, they're at an age, they don't know if you're making fun of them, they don't know what's going on, they're feeling insecure, and you take out a deck of cards and five of them start screaming, "I've seen it," you know, and hello. They lift up your coat sometimes to see if there's something hidden underneath. I mean, they can be really rude. Mm. And as a magician, they're a terrible audience. But what they need is 4 years of high school and maybe 2 to 4 years of college, and now they are the perfect audience for a magician. And you want to say to yourself, what happened to that little animal mind that didn't believe anything until it was proven? Now, as a magician, I might want to put that mind on vacation for 5 minutes, not destroy it, but just put it on vacation, right? Because I think, yes, I think we suffer from over-rationality, as you were saying much earlier. But as a human being, I say to myself, what happened to that little animal mind that didn't believe things until it was demonstrated? And why has education dulled that mind to the extent that my job as a magician with college graduates is the easiest thing in the world sometimes? Because they'll believe anything you tell them. So I stopped doing bar mitzvahs, and now I just do post-college. It's safer.
Clever.
But in part, the magician creates the audience. You know, I mean, my audience doesn't think what I'm doing has more importance than I do. You know, my audience never thinks my magic has more value than I think it has. So it starts with me. I have to move beyond triviality and take what I'm doing a little seriously, you know. I wanted to do a lecture years ago called Taking Fun Seriously.
In a way, that's almost what ritual is. It's like,
isn't it?
Serious fun.
Isn't it? Yes.
If there's not an element of liveliness to it, it's rarely transformative. I had a question for you about what it's like to be a magician and have the knowledge and understanding of human behavior and perception and of the gaps and misthinking that goes on in a lot of people's minds as they try to understand what's going on around them, in terms of alienation. Because if you look at the anthropological record and you read about shamans, you'll find in a lot of societies, while the shaman had power, it was an ambiguous power that was threatening to a lot of the members of the society,
yes,
even if he had healing power or she.
Yes.
And so they were in many ways somewhat alienated structurally from their society. They were kind of like, they had intellectual knowledge that other people didn't have. They were feared. Sometimes they were even mocked. They sometimes were very low status, even if they were people that everyone would turn to when they were sick. I'm curious if being a, you know, philosophically aware magician in our world now has its own kind of odd alienation that goes along with it in terms of knowing and seeing things and being treated even in different ways than your rank civilians.
I suppose you could look at it that way. I tend to look at it kind of the reverse, that I just have lots of opportunities, and that my job as a performer is to gear my performance to the audience that is at hand. And my job is not intellectual conversion. It's really performance magic. So I might have all these ideas, but when it gets right down to a show, if the show is just... I had the following experience years ago. I'm doing this show for a bunch of stockbrokers. It's a Saturday afternoon, Sunday early evening show, and they've been playing volleyball, drinking beer, and probably snorting cocaine in those days most of the afternoon. So now it's time for the show in the basement. And as I begin the show, I mean, people are yelling, and not at me, but yelling at each other. And at one point, the phone rings at like 5 feet from me in the middle of a routine. And the hostess picks it up and has like a five-minute phone call. And people are yelling, and suddenly the light goes on in my head. There's only one person in this room who's not having a good time, and that's me. And maybe I should just get with the program, because that's what the program seems to be, and stop fighting it. And so I just did, you know, I just jumped in and got a lot goofier and whatnot. And the guy, you know, not only paid my fee, but gave me a $100 tip at the end, which made me much more positive that they had been starting cocaine. And that was that. So, I mean, you know, an entertainer, the first job is to entertain. And teaching and learning and suggesting and opening doors, that's I think, a secondary function of the entertainer.
Hmm. Do you think there's any way that you can inculcate in the audience the willingness to stop going, what's the trick? Oh, I know it's the trick.
Oh, yeah, I do. That's what I meant when I said we create our audiences in part. Look, if I start giving you everything to examine, What am I doing? I'm asking you to think about methods. See, okay, here's one way to look at it. I think there are two philosophies of magic going on in the magic world today. One is theatrical magic. One is, and we can see the difference with the act of passing a hoop over a floating object. Okay?
Right.
My friend Jamie Swiss, James Randi, Penn and Teller, all of whom I think of as friends, they would say you have to pass the hoop. If you don't pass the hoop, this is just Peter Pan. Magic has an intellectual element that needs to be incorporated. You just can't have people flying without proving something. And then there are other people, probably Jeff McBride, me, Bob Neal, Max Impart, you know, who would say, they'd say, no, if you pass the hoop, you're inviting people to think about methods and get into an analytic frame of mind. Now, who's right? Well, neither, probably, because we're both trying to absolutize what we're saying. But what I teach my students is that magicians need to be judicious and thoughtful before they pass a hoop. Because passing that hoop takes you out of the state of wonderment. And you know, when you were talking about wonder at the top of the show, you know, I was thinking, do we experience wonder or are we grasped by wonder? And the other thing I was thinking was, of course people don't experience wonder. To experience wonder, you have to live in the present. If you're living in the past and the future, you don't experience wonder ever. Wonder is an experience of the present moment. And since we work so hard to stay out of the present moment, it's not surprising that we don't experience a lot of wonder.
Well, I love the description of these two schools because it's really quite profound to me. The more I learn about the sort of inner dynamics of contemporary theatrical magic, the more profound it gets to me.
And fascinating.
In terms of, yeah, of actually highlighting a fundamental tension in the modern psyche. I mean, this is a baseline issue that everyone is facing on some level, which is like, what do we do at the edges of rationality? And the scientific impulse or the analytic impulse or the traditionally skeptical impulse is to say, well, any mystery that lies outside of my machinery of facts and knowledge is fair game for attack and deconstruction and absorption into my network of knowledge and facts. And there's another side of our beings, and we all have it in different ways. I think some people repress it. I think some people mock it. I think some people overindulge it. Is this other side that's like, that knows on some basic level that however wide our network of knowledge and facts grows, there's always a mystery. And that on some fundamental level, we are always living in relationship to mystery. And these two philosophies, and indeed the very dynamics of the theatrical magic act, not a occult magic act, but a theatrical magic act, stage both sides, skepticism and wonderment. And the ambiguity between them, to me, it seems to be one of the most interesting places where we work out this fundamental state of mind that we're all facing.
And magic, you know, in one sense, is an invitation to just take a vacation from your rational mind for a while. You know, I mean, we need our rational mind because we have to sign contracts and count change. But you don't need it all the time. So I think magic is, you know, most of my performing work now is corporate cocktail parties where I'm doing like little 10-minute shows, and I look at these as little 10-minute opportunities for people to just take a deep breath and have fun and not have to think and figure out. So I try very hard not to let people get into that rational frame of mind when I'm performing. And that's why I'm very careful about passing hoops.
And then how much of that has to do with story? I mean, I was watching one of your routines last night, and I actually wanted to let people know about the documentary on you that you had alerted me to before, A Magical Vision by Michael Kaplan, C-A-P-L-A-N. So folks can just Google that, and it's a fascinating hour-long documentary on Eugene and some of his cohorts.
And it was a routine, and what I was aware of is you were telling this fascinating story about the Inquisition, and it was this whole invocation of a historical moment with religious overtones, and at the same time you were doing this interesting card trick with ripping these cards and sort of folding them in certain ways that seemed to defy logic, and it became really clear to me that there really were two things that were happening, even
right.
though it was one synthetic performance,
right.
there was what you were doing with your hands and the cards, and then there was the story that you were telling. And,
which is a political story.
Yeah, and it suddenly opened up to me how you can take the same methods and even the same effects to some degree and wrap them in totally different ways that have very, very different effects because of the power of story rather than the power of your particular skill set with manipulating cards. As you get farther and farther into your career, do you find yourself paying more attention to the stories, or is it still an equal balance between stories and new methods?
Both, but probably a little heavier on stories now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because that story is a good one, the Inquisition, because, you know, the Inquisition to me is about what happens when we give so-called religious people political power. Namely, they want to kill the rest of us. And that's the message of the trick. Now, does everybody get it? No. But I'm not there to preach. I'm there to perform. But the message is there if you want to see it. And I think that's my job. You know, there was that great statement by Cugliano, the horizon of the unknown moves outward with the horizon of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something that magic also reminds us. You know, one of the reasons magic has lasted so long is because magic says you're living in the middle of a capital M mystery, and you don't even know it.
Well, it's true, and I think people forget what the word mystery even means.
Yes.
Because we have this connotation with it now with, like, detective novels, where it's something to be solved.
Right.
When, in fact, the real word mystery means a divine revelation,
right.
or the mystical presence of God. But it's really both of those things. Like you said, it's the passing the hoop. But then the more you pass the hoop, it gets to that revelation where you realize you don't know. Like, you can only pass the hoop so many times before you get down to the bottom of it. And then it is that big mystery with a capital M, and that magic has that ability to open up a space for that. Like you said, like a vacation, like that place outside of time and space where we usually live, and you can, like, kind of just rend the veil a little bit and have a little peek into that kind of deep down bottom of the secret.
Mm-hmm. Yes. See, what we call a mystery novel is really a problem novel.
Yeah, exactly.
Because there's a solution, and a mystery can't be solved. It can only be experienced.
Yeah.
And I think the message of many philosophies and religions is that when we truly experience mystery, the result is transformative.
Mm.
And I think that transformation is the base metaphor of magic. When you just go through all the weeds and bushes, you finally get to the heart of magic, which is about transformation.
And now, how in your life do you find yourself experiencing that magic? I mean, in a way, there must be moments when you're almost envious of crowds, because they can get this full blast of utter wonderment, and you're like, well, I may not have known exactly how that was done, but I have a pretty good idea. If you're also in the audience. That must be an interesting dynamic as well, because in a sense,
right.
you are sacrificing your own potential for a certain kind of
right.
wonderment for the ability to give that to others.
Yes, because as a magician, one on the, quote, inside, unquote, I have to be in two minds. I have to be in the mind that's going, wow, but I also have to be in the mind of, why is this working? Why is this not working? What's going on here? Why is he saying that? Et cetera, et cetera. So I find myself, you know, in that paradox, that tension, when I watch magic shows, there's a part of me that wants to let go of it all, but on the other hand, there's another part of me that doesn't want to let go of it, but that wants to understand, why is this working? Why isn't that working? And so on.
Well, that again is the shaman, right? Like Mircea Eliade defines a shaman as the master of ecstasy, meaning
yes.
they can go into unconsciousness while remaining conscious.
Yes.
Right? That like anyone else that goes into an ecstatic state is not necessarily a shaman. The shaman is the one that can still navigate world while they're in the cuckoo land, right? So that's how the magician, like yourself, is able to keep their logical mind, but at the same time traverse that wonderment.
Yes. But it comes at a cost.
Yeah.
And the cost is that you never experience primarily one or the other. You're always in the tension between them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just part of being in a profession. That's probably true of golfers and, you know, radio hosts and
filmmakers, for sure.
You go to
filmmakers,
sure.
People who know film,
everybody.
You know, they're not always that fun to go see movies with because they're just, like, breaking it down all the time.
Right,
Or you learn a little bit about how electronic music is made, and you go, oh, that's pretty easy. And then you hear stuff, you go, oh, I know how they're doing it. It's really funny how I think you're right that sort of cross-profession is part of what it means to be in a profession, is a certain kind of disenchantment.
Yes, indeed, disenchantment.
Now, can you give us a little slice on how you see the world of magic changing right now? Like, you know, as you said, it comes and goes in the culture. Certain trends rise and fall with the rise of the internet and DVDs and other ways that people are learning magic. And how is the culture of magicians changing now?
That's a hard one because, you know, we're right in the middle of it. And so when you're in the middle of something, you often don't see what's really going on. It seems as though, in terms of marketing magic, that the base product is a DVD that sells for $19.95 or $29.95, and more often than not contains one magic trick taught, demonstrated, and taught. There's a big emphasis on what is called street magic, where people are engaged on the street and people and magicians perform for them. And of course, the younger people that are getting into magic are getting into it via their computer, and so magic magazine circulations are down, I think, worldwide, but that's true with magazines generally. And these kids tend not to join magic clubs. But I'll tell you, when I was a kid, we didn't join magic clubs either, really. And so it might be that, you know, earlier we were talking about this syndrome that I see over and over again with students, where I was into magic as a kid, I got out of it, and 30 to 40 years old, I'm back in it again. Now, when the kids that are, you know, primarily computer connected to magic get older, maybe they'll seek, you know, more concrete socialization with the club members, you know, as opposed to doing this all blind. Because that's one of the dangers of the internet, God knows. You go to these magician chat rooms, and who's giving the advice? I mean, you don't even know who you're talking to. And they're just loaded with people giving advice. And, of course, the person who has been into magic 2 weeks has the same authority, let's go back to that word, as Max Maven or Jeff McBride.
Yeah, that problem, of course, is across the board with the internet, but it's particularly interesting with magic, and I might be wrong here, but my experience is that if you go into there's a magic shop here in San Francisco a couple blocks away, and I went in there with a pal of mine who buys the occasional magic book, but is not a practitioner. And he went in, and there was a certain book he wanted. I don't recall what it was. But it was a very beautifully produced book, like a lot of magic books are very beautifully produced. So if you're into, if you're a bibliophile, they're pretty cool, even if you're not a practitioner. And he went in there, and he was like, oh, I like that book. And the guy kind of hazed him. He said, well, what do you know, and what have you done? And he tested him to see, in a way, whether he was inside enough to to deserve getting the book, and he was clearly not going to give it to us until my friend explained exactly why he wanted it, and he kind of begrudgingly gave it to him. And my impression was that in a lot of the traditional realms, there was a kind of not only hierarchy of authority, but a certain way in which you had to kind of be inculcated into the magician way of doing things in order to get access to things, and it
right.
would sort of, you go further. And
right.
now, presumably, that whole structure is kind of scrambled by the Internet.
Right. But, you know, the problem with the Internet is it doesn't come with a user's guide. And so eventually, I think, you know, if you're really into something, you're going to move beyond that level of involvement. And if you're not into it, you know, think of all the, you know, think of guitar players, you know, there's a whole range of people that just do it for real, for money, for huge crowds, and people that just do it, pick a note or two at home. And there's this whole range of people in between, same with magicians. There are people who are really dedicated to this thing, and then there are people who are just window shopping, and, you know, and that's all okay, too. I often thought that, you know, when the masked magician was exposing the secrets on TV and making many magicians absolutely crazy, I often thought, you know, you know, 30 years from now, someone's interviewing the top magician of the day, and they say to this woman or man, whatever, well, how did you get into magic? And the person answers, oh, I saw this really weird magic show on TV with this guy in a mask showing how magic tricks were done, and I thought, this is kind of cool. And so, you know, it's the old Taoist story, who knows what's right or wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone, you know, has been very negative about these guys, but they might be, you know, I got into magic via a magic set being given to me when I was about 7 years old.
And there's no way to know even if the new sort of spirit of kind of aggressively disenchanted skeptical magic, and then there's a lot of mentalism along the same lines with Darren Brown, where there's, it's not about a kind of ritual sense of or poetic sense of wonder so much as a kind of demonstration or a game of puzzles, that who knows, that might actually just, you know, flower in another direction as well.
Well, yeah, because pendulums have to go back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the thing in magic is that Houdini has been the poster boy for magicians and for the general audiences throughout, for, you know, 80-some years now. You know, name a magician, Houdini, bang. But at the same time, I lost my thought there.
but Houdini himself, even though he loved to debunk the spiritualist seance mongers.
Well, that's the other part, that Houdini is also the poster boy for the debunkers, but I wonder about that sometimes. Jamie Swiss and I have arguments about this one. Because, look, if you just go rent Man from Beyond, his movie, it's about reincarnation, folks.
Yeah.
How much of a debunker was he? You know?
He never stopped going. He never stopped going.
So I'm not willing to give Houdini the poster boy status for the debunkers that they want to claim for him. Because
I think
it was a much more mixed bag.
Exactly.
And he was inspired to going to the seances because he wanted to contact his dead mother. I mean, he had a very emotional, close spiritual connection to it.
Right, and there was also the fact, let's get onto another level, where he had lost a lot of money in Hollywood making these movies that didn't work out. And now to fill theaters, he had the best thing of all, the spiritualist expose ending.
Mm-hmm.
And that filled the theaters for him. And that's what he needed at that point in his career.
Exactly. It's all
so there's
a lot more
going on
than it looks
just,
initially.
Right,
but
there's a lot more going on, right, Eric?
Yeah. So we're winding up here, Eugene. I wanted to let people know that they can find out more about you and read some of your wonderful writings at magicbeard.com. That's magic without a K. And again, I also encourage people to check out the documentary online by Michael Kaplan, CAPLAN. Anything else you're coming out with, Eugene, that you want to let people know about?
Oh, I'm just getting ready to go to Las Vegas tomorrow and doing a class there. I'm involved with the Magic School in Las Vegas, and people come from all over the world.
Well, wonderful. Good luck with that, and thanks again for being on Expanding Mind. I'm Eric Davis with Maja Daou. Keep your minds open.